From VinePair's New York City headquarters, I'm Joanna Sciarrino.
And in Seattle, Washington, I'm Zach Jabal.
And this is the VinePair podcast. Zach, we are sadly without Adam this week and next. But
yeah,
that's okay.
Well, today and Monday.
Yes.
Adam is, as mentioned, somewhere in the Caribbean doing Caribbean things, probably, hopefully.
Yes.
Pretty checked out, which is good. I appreciate the ability to disconnect. So we know he'll listen, though.
Maybe.
So, yeah.
Or maybe when he gets back. But yeah.
Yeah.
But what have you been reading lately?
So the thing that was on the site that was most interesting to me, because it really it got at something that I think about or get asked about from time to time, and also prompted a little bit of additional thought for me on something that I hadn't considered, was John Sumner's piece about wine gadgets. And
yeah.
like I think everyone listening who is something of a wine, either a professional or just enthusiast, you know, you run across these kinds of things in people's homes. Other people sometimes gift them to you or ask you about them. And they range from the truly ludicrous to the, I would say, sort of more mundane. But in particular, the sort of scrutiny and perhaps even vitriol assigned to the winged corkscrew, the thing that that kind of, you know, draws the most ire, I found really interesting. And I was, because look, when I first got into wine, I was confronted with this problem, right? I was working in restaurants, and so I was using a waiter's, you know, wine key or whatever, as most professionals do. But, you know, you go over to friends' houses or family members' houses, and this is what they would often have. It's certainly what my mom had growing up and all that. And I was thinking as I read the piece and then thought about it a little bit further, you know, why was this way to open a bottle of wine so appealing to people? And I think what it comes down to is the distinction between like a wine key that you would see used in a restaurant and one of these winged corkscrews is basically, it comes down to two things. One is that when you open a lot of bottles of wine in a professional setting, you learn pretty quickly the correct amount of force to apply, because while a cork is a relatively solid, sturdy object, it can break with kind of careless opening, especially, mm-hmm. again, think about this in the home setting. If your bottle's been stored improperly, like upright, dried out, so the cork has dried out, or just older, or who knows what. And the sort of winged corkscrew takes that element largely out of the equation. Like you can't really exert more or less force on it when you open it, because you're just kind of pushing the sort of arms down and it's doing all the lifting for you. And I think that's a big part of it. I also think the sort of auger setup, even though it does kind of mangle corks in a way that is inelegant, it also kind of makes it easier to get the sort of worm into the middle of the cork, or at least into the cork. And again, I think about like how for a lot of people using a more conventional corkscrew, one of the big like pain points for people, one of the concerns, I saw this a lot training newer servers and stuff, is like, am I going to not get the corkscrew in straight? Am I not going to get it in the correct, you know, in the middle, et cetera, so that I'm going to have some of the worm exposed as I open it, or I'm going to break the cork, whatever. And whether it really or truly works or not, the winged corkscrew appears to take that concern away. So I was left with both a newfound, in a weird way, appreciation for its appeal to the sort of at-home drinker, but also reminded of just how clunky and like annoying a piece of wine opening equipment it is.
Yeah. It was a little surprising to me as well that he really went for that versus a whole host of other wine gadgets I thought he was going to go for. But yeah, I thought that piece was fun. Is worm the technical term?
I mean, I'm definitely not a technical term. It's what I've always heard used to describe the, you know, the part of the corkscrew that goes into the cork.
Yes, that makes plenty of sense to me. I just never heard it referred to that before.
Yeah. Oh, trust me. You spend too much time thinking about these things when your job is to open bottles of wine for a living. So,
I bet.
Yeah. That said, also, he does mention it here, and I this is not a paid endorsement, but the Durand is a really cool and very valuable tool if you open older bottles of wine. It's sort of impractical otherwise.
Right.
Well, it's like a mix of a two-pronged opener and a corkscrew, which means that like the problem for me with the Osso or the two-pronged opener is I never was like dexterous enough to get it to work with any consistency and had some issues with it when trying to use it. And the Durand kind of solves that problem by using a corkscrew to hold on to the cork while you use the sort of prongs to lift it out of the neck of the bottle. So it is a very useful tool if you find yourself opening older bottles of wine on the regular, which is probably not many people, but is enough people to make it a, you know, a useful tool for some of us. So anyhow,
yeah.
Joanna, what about you? What on the site was your kind of little baby this week?
Yeah, my favorite one this week was written by Olivia White, basically exploring the opportunity for Baijiu stateside. And I thought this piece was interesting because I think Baijiu, for people who aren't familiar, is like a sorghum-based spirit. It's from China. It's extremely popular there. I think it's like the number one spirit in the world, but just really hasn't found a home in the United States. I think a lot of the reason is because its flavor profile is somewhat challenging, but basically Olivia's piece kind of explores if, you know, the American palate is more ready for it than it's ever been in the past because of the work that other spirits like Mezcal have done, kind of paving the way. In my experience having Baijiu, because I did study and live in China for a little while, it's an interesting spirit. I think the drinking culture around it, it's more like a shooting spirit. You drink it, yeah. I would say, like more how I imagine Russian people drink vodka. And it's funny because Olivia spoke with Joaquin Simo in this piece, and he said that back in the day when he first encountered Baijiu, like a lot of it was very bad, like what was coming to the American market. It tasted like, what did he say? Baby vomit. And yeah, that was kind of my experience with it. But we're definitely seeing it on more cocktail menus and beverage programs today. So I think it'll be really interesting to see, yeah, how that evolves in the next couple of years, and if it really does have a place. You know, Olivia's piece also mentions, like, as it's paired with food and kind of introducing it in a different kind of drinking experience that maybe is more compatible with the American palate. So I thought that piece was interesting.
Yeah, it was especially interesting to me because Caitlin just got back from Hong Kong and brought a bottle of Baijiu for me, which we haven't actually opened yet. We've been sort of trying to figure out the time because, as I said to her, it was like, you know, having had very little experience with it. I mean, I've tasted a few in my day, but nothing that really was super exciting to me. Although, also to be fair, nothing that tasted to me like baby vomit.
Yeah.
Fortunately.
Yes.
I do think that I was like, this needs to be a thing that we open when, like, if it turns out that drinking it by itself is not what we want to do, I have the sort of bandwidth to, like, try to make a drink with it. And so at the dinner table isn't really the time and place for that with our kids and stuff like that. So I think we will, maybe this coming weekend, we'll dive into it. Maybe I'll talk about it on the Monday episode. We'll see. But yeah, it'll be interesting to give a little bit of an opportunity to taste it, because this was what she brought back was something I cannot remember the producer now, but considered at least, you know, in the shop she was at in Hong Kong, you know, one of the better bottles. So we'll see.
Yeah. So speaking of things on the site, today, as you're listening to this episode, we launched a really big package that we're super excited about called Margarita Nation, basically exploring, you know, where we're at with the most popular cocktail in America right now. I think people love the margarita. There's no denying that. But I think people's version or what their idea of a margarita is very different, depending on who you speak to. And so, Zach, we thought we'd talk about this today.
Yeah.
Kind of how far the margarita has come, where it's at right now, and you know, how much we think it can achieve.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the most interesting things to me about, in particular, a piece by Robert Simonson and more generally this conversation is the sort of ways in which the margarita as almost a brand name have reached a level where, you know, as Robert quotes several bartenders and bar managers in his piece, basically you put the word margarita in the drink and it's going to sell.
Yeah.
And it's going to sell almost regardless of what the ingredients are and whether it bears even a passing resemblance to the sort of classic margarita. And I think that, you know, it's very interesting that the comparison is drawn several times in the piece between the margarita craze, the martini craze, and in particular, the sort of suffix teeny and Rita being applied to lots of things also. And to me, what's most interesting here in a sense to discuss is what's interesting to me is I think now in this sort of second martini era, we think of the martini and we think of a vibe, right? We think of a sort of aesthetic, a kind of sophistication, a sort of, you know, as was discussed recently on the pod, a sort of, you know, as Tim said, you know, it's not, he thinks it's not a drink for outside. Obviously, we've heard from many people that disagree, but point is, you know, the martini and maybe now the sort of concept of the martini evokes a certain kind of emotion, a certain kind of place, a certain kind of experience. And the margarita does that too. And I'm wondering if you think, as perhaps I do, Joanna, that the margarita is, because that mood is more playful, is more kind of all, anytime, any place, that it is even more ripe for this kind of broad and kind
interpretation.
Of catch-all, yeah, than the martini, where I think the martini as a, you know, the sort of appletini thing always felt very odd and felt like much more about literally the glassware than about the contents of the glass. Whereas I think the margarita, because of its sort of, again, both ubiquity, but also versatility and less kind of high end pretension, maybe is more, even more amenable to this kind of, just kind of being whatever you want it to be.
Yeah, I think that I like the comparison and I think it's fun and I think it's smart, but I see them kind of differently because, you know, back in the 90s, I guess, when we saw this like explosion of teenies, they felt very, very far from what the original cocktail was, like historically, of a martini. And I think with the margarita, you know, this feels different to me because as many variations as there are, as many riffs and as, you know, kind of crazy as they get with, you know, you've got avocado in them, they're spicy, they're whatever. I think there is a common through line with the base spirit being an agave-based spirit, whether that's tequila or mezcal. And I think that with the martini, you kind of lost that, I think, for a lot of them, because the base spirit was kind of different in every variation, right? Not every, but like a lot of the variations. Or was it always like vodka? I don't know. It just feels very different to me.
Well, I think it's more like the martini, if you think about like the classic formulation of the martini, vodka or gin, the savory element of it, the kind of spirit forward element of it is the thing that got very quickly subsumed in all of the other flavors, you know, many of which were fruity, sweet, etc. And, you know, yes, they might have had vodka in them, but they were not like a lemon drop, right? Even a lemon drop, which I think when well made is actually a pretty well balanced cocktail, is really much more about the citrus than, you know, the vodka or whatever that's in it. And because the margarita at its core is really about citrus too, you know, both lime juice and orange liqueur, at least in the sort of most traditional form. And then of course, tequila on top of that, or in addition to that, it doesn't feel like you're kind of moving away from what the heart of the drink is in a way, even if you start adding in a bunch of other stuff to it.
Right. Yeah. It was funny because when we were kind of thinking through this package, we were talking about the editorial team was talking about how, and it's kind of mentioned in Robert's piece as well, that there's this idea that if a cocktail has tequila in it, it's a margarita. And I think Ivy Mick says it in Robert's piece, but just like, no, that's a tequila cocktail. But there, I think from a consumer point of view, there is this desire to kind of put assign margarita to anything that is a tequila cocktail. Because I think that's what they associate tequila. A lot of people associate tequila with a margarita.
Well, and I think you think about how, in the end, even though this is sometimes hard for you or me or for other drinks professionals to remember, the average drinker knows almost nothing about how to make drinks. Like the average drinker, even as we talk about, you know, in a sort of post-COVID world where people were making things at home, a lot of people have no idea. If you said to them, even if you put the ingredients in front of them and said, make a margarita for me, I don't know what you would get. I mean, you might get the ingredients in, but in what ratios and in what, you know, kind of formation, I have no idea. And so in a sense, what can people take away from a margarita, or what do people hold in their mind about a margarita? Well, it's that it has tequila in it.
It's basic components. Yep.
Yeah. Maybe it has lime juice in it, but again, a lot of people put orange juice in their margaritas, sure. You know, not orange liqueur. And I think it's the same. That's where the parallel with the martini is particularly strong. Because what do people take away from a martini? Well, it was served in that glass.
That glass.
Like, literally, that's the thing that is etched in people's minds. Served in that glass. And I don't know, probably has vodka in it, or maybe gin if they're really thinking hard. And that's kind of all you needed to do to convince a lot of drinkers that what they were drinking was a martini of sorts. And I think what's, you know, interesting for me with the margarita is in this positioning of it, and this question of kind of like, do you make a drink more approachable, more popular, more sellable by calling it a such and such margarita, as opposed to whatever else is in the drink, right? Like some of the examples in Robert's piece and that we just see out there in the wild, you're like, okay, I guess this is a margarita in that it includes one or two margarita ingredients.
Yeah.
But it isn't really centered around, like, the dominant flavor is often something else entirely.
Yeah. How do you feel about that? Because I think we have a number of different opinions from, you know, bar professionals in this piece, but I think it's super interesting.
Well, I think I come at it from two perspectives. One is that naming drinks is hard, and so I'm always understand someone whose inclination is like, let's go with something easy. And the such and such margarita is easier in a way than coming up with a new name that's not going to have any resonance with people, and that is going to rely on them like actually reading the ingredients and thinking about them. And look, a lot of these drinks that we see in this piece and that we see out there have unusual ingredients, like the mushroom margarita at Super Bueno with huitlacoche. Like, that's not an ingredient that most people are going to be familiar with. And if that's in the name of the drink, or even just the thing that people are sort of connecting to with that drink, probably fewer people are going to be willing to order it, or at least they're going to need to be convinced that they'll like it in a way that if you call it a mushroom margarita, okay. I mean, some people are maybe going to be turned off by that concept, but they're at least going to be intrigued by it, if nothing else, even if they decide not to order it. And so I think, you know, that from that standpoint, I totally understand it. I also think, like, okay, bear with me for a moment here.
Okay.
I think that the margarita is just, in its, at least here in this country and in popular culture, is so much less of a sort of stuffy, fussy drink that it shouldn't be something that we feel like, oh my God, if you don't make it in the exact original classical way, you're doing it wrong. I think in a way, the martini has more of that vibe, especially now, right?
Like now,
the martini is a drink that, and historically too, I mean, I think before the 90s sort of craze of everything teeny, it really was a drink that was like, this is what a martini is. And if you are a martini drinker, you are a certain kind of drinker, you have a certain kind of bearing. I mean, again, this is an era too when people had a drink that they drank. Like there were the people who had a martini every single day when they got home from work or whatever, right? In a way that I don't think a lot of people drink these days, or fewer people drink these days at least. And so I think that the margarita, by virtue of its slight exoticism, it's sort of anything goes, anytime goes kind of vibe. Again, the margarita is an indoor and outdoor drink. It's a summer drink and it's a winter drink. It's a daytime and a nighttime drink. Like it is more kind of universal, probably part of why it is the most popular cocktail in the country. And therefore, it is, I think, in a way, much more welcoming of all of these variations. So I don't get up in arms about it. I don't feel personally like, oh my God, if you put a drink on your cocktail list that has the word margarita in it, it had better only consist of lime juice, tequila, and orange liqueur. Like that to me is that's for Tim to take up or whatever.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I think that that's a really good point. I think that with a lot of people in this country have, like, the way that they've consumed margaritas, and that might be frozen, it might be in, you know, pitchers, like, it's just much more casual, or like it's a little more, it possibly can be more lowbrow, right? And I think that,
or just less stuffy.
Less stuffy.
don't know if it's lowbrow. It's just not.
Well, I don't know. I think about like the chain restaurants and stuff like that. And that's definitely popularized the cocktail and the margarita deals, right? You're getting, I don't know, like $5 margaritas or things like that. Like there's always been something about the drink that has made the way you consume it a little bit different from other classic cocktails.
Yeah, I mean, but think of it this way, right? Like when I ask you, Joanna, like what is someone holding a martini, like a classic martini, what are they wearing? Well, you're probably thinking like a cocktail dress or a suit or something.
Sure.
And I ask you, what is someone drinking a margarita wearing? They're wearing shorts. They're wearing a sundress. They may not have shoes on at all. Like
right.
It is just a different kind of drink with a different kind of
I mean, Margaritaville,
vibe.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And all of those things, I think, explain why it is a better canvas in a way to play on, and the fact that it's so popular and so recognizable to people is a big part of this. But I actually have a question I want to ask you, which is not just about what clothes people are wearing while they drink these.
Sure.
That is, but does kind of work almost contrary to this. So the piece that we mostly were referencing, you know, Robert Simonson's piece, talks a lot about all these variations. But what I'm really curious to get your opinion on, Joanna, is do you think there is space for the really high end margarita? Like we have seen certainly in the martini craze, one of the many directions that has gone is we're going to serve you a $30, a $40, a $50 martini, right? It's going to have very expensive gin or vodka in it. It might have a very elaborate garnish. It's going to be prepared in this very specific way. Maybe it's prepared table side, etc. And there is a lot of, because of maybe, I think, the martini's air of sophistication, there is perhaps some appetite for that kind of drink. I'm curious, do you think there is a similar appetite for a very high-end margarita?
Yeah, I think that's a good question that kind of taps into our last conversation about Blanco tequila and commanding higher prices for Blanco tequila. And I think that there's an appetite for it, but it might not have the mass appeal that like classic chain restaurant margarita will have. So I think that bar, like probably high end cocktail bars, could get away with like a clarified margarita or, you know, a really expensive margarita because you're using very expensive aged tequila, or, you know, there are enough expensive ingredients that can go in as, you know, plenty of opportunity to put in expensive ingredients for to make something a margarita riff. For people who like that drink, I think they would go for something like that. I do think so.
I'm not as
You're skeptical.
Confident.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, again, not to reference our last podcast too much, but I do think that, you know, for those of you, hopefully all of you who listened to it, I think that one of the challenges that we saw in talking about that in talking through that sort of conversation is how do you create value in tequila, right? And if we're talking about an expensive, a premium margarita, it's got to start with, I think, the tequila or mezcal, I guess, potentially, that's going in it. And in particular, it's probably got to start with a pretty premium Blanco tequila, because I don't know how many margarita variations you've tried made with barrel-aged tequila or agave. It can work. I mean, I think reposado can be an interesting ingredient in a margarita.
Yeah.
I think once you start getting into an añejo and things like that, it's pretty hard to make that flavor profile work without going sort of more into like a traditional sour recipe, which is a little different and can be really good. I mean, a tequila sour can be quite a tasty cocktail, to be honest, but is not really a margarita, again, whether or not that means anything. So I think that there's that. I think the other part of it is, again, I think the audience that seems to exist for some of these higher end expressions of tequila does seem more interested in enjoying it as more of a sipped spirit than as a cocktail ingredient. And to some extent, that's true with any premium, really high end spirit. I mean, we've talked about this in some ways with whiskey and things like that. Like, does it make sense to turn these things into cocktails or not? I think it's where it actually kind of works well for the martini is that gin in particular is a spirit that no one is really out there saying the best way to enjoy premium, really, really high end gin is just by sipping it neat.
Sometimes
I know those
Tim
people
says
exist
that.
Out there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, okay. this is not let's all, you know, kind of shit on Tim podcast. No. I actually think he's right about most of these things, but I do think that you're pushing a big rock up a hill if you're trying to convince people to drink, you know, sort of room temp gin neat. good luck on that one. So I do think that there's something to be said about you're kind of, if you're going to try and sell really high end agave, you're probably going to do it as a, you know, sippable pour, a shot or something like that. And I think the other part is, again, the margarita is sort of anything goes, anytime goes party vibe nature, at least as interpreted here, makes it hard to turn into a really, really premium drink. Except, I think, if you change the presentation. And in honesty, I think if you put it in a coupe or a V or something like that, serve it up and present it honestly and perhaps ironically more like a martini, you might be able to make that land with people more than in a bucket with ice, salt on the rim or whatever. That's such a powerful image to people, but it's not an image that they're going to pay $30 for, I don't think.
Yeah. I don't know. I think that there are still some people who will. Just like these places the, you know, very expensive, like, reserve cocktails on their menu, which arguably, like, ruin the base spirit by turning them into cocktails. There will always be someone who will go for something like that, even if you kind of lose the nuances of the tequila as a result. I wanted to say that, you know, in Robert's piece, he kind of refers to the margarita as a genre, and I thought that was really smart. But also just kind of in relation to the prompt that I asked you earlier, like, I like it. I like this idea of calling things a margarita. I think with it there, as long as it can promise the balance of what someone might expect from a classic margarita, or the same drinking experience, I think it's fine.
Yeah, and I think
it's a good thing to do, a smart thing to do.
Yeah, and I mean, to me, it's kind of one of these things where, like, again, not to be too, like, hard on cocktail nerd types, but, like, you'll hear from someone, you have already heard from someone probably, who will say, like, well, you know, really, the margarita is just a variation on a daisy, right? And it's kind of this classic formulation of cocktail, which was, you know, spirit, lime, orange liqueur. But I honestly think it makes more sense and just connects more to people to say, well, nowadays, let's just call all of those things margaritas, right? And that's the drink that people recognize. It's the name that people recognize. It gives them the understanding of this sort of balancing point between spirit, lime,
sweetness,
probably one other flavoring, sweetening agent of one kind or another. And, you know, just because the nomenclature was used first for a different drink, or the nomenclature exists from the past, I mean, that's cool for historian types, and I think it's interesting to kind of, you know, be aware of that. But for the average drinker, for the average bartender, for the average kind of anyone engaging with beverage alcohol, I think, yeah, the idea of the margarita less as a specific drink and more as a class of drinks, a kind of template that can be and is riffed on endlessly, makes a lot more sense, because in the end, you're right. What matters with the margarita is the experience it promises to you. And it turns out that there are a lot of different flavor combinations that can take you to that same basic destination.
Yeah. Yeah. Let us know what you think. Is anything with tequila in it a margarita? Tequila and lime? Are you sick of the margarita variations and riffs? podcasts@vinepair.com. We'd love to hear from you guys. And Zach, I will talk to you on Monday.
Sounds great.
Thanks so much for listening to the Vine Pair Podcast, the flagship podcast of the Vine Pair Podcast Network. If you love listening to this show, or even if you don't, but I really hope that you do, as much as we really do love making it, then please drop us a review or a rating wherever it is that you get your podcast, whether that be iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, anywhere. If you are listening to this on a device right now, through an app, however you got this audio, please drop a review. It really helps everyone else discover the show. And now for some totally awesome credits. So, the Vine Pair Podcast is recorded in our New York City headquarters and in Seattle, Washington, in Zach Chabal's basement. It is recorded by Zach, mastered, and produced by Zach. He loves all the credit. Keep giving it to him. Drop his name in the reviews. He's going to love hearing how much you love him. It is also recorded in New York City by our tastings director, Keith Beavers, who is the managing director of the entire Vine Pair Podcast Network. I'd also love to give a shout out to our editor-in-chief, Joanna Sherino, who joins us on every single podcast as our third and most important host. Thank you as well to the entire Vine Pair staff and everyone who's been involved in making Vine Pair as special as it's become. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next week.